And I just want to wonder if, since you're there, we know who you are, we're going to go around the table and sort of introduce ourselves so you know who's at the other end of this line.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And by the way, this conversation is being recorded. So,
okay.
And you're okay with that?
Of course.
Okay.
My name is Alex Masri, and I'm a member of the research team here at the SCIS.
My name is Landon Strobel. I'm also a member of the research team.
I'm Alexis Sevendinger with the SCIC.
And I'm Randall Dodd, with also with the research team at the FCIC.
And I'm Stephen Mintz, as you know. Let me give you just a little bit of background. I imagine you're somewhat familiar with us, but we've got the mission to uncover the causes of the financial crisis and where the systemic weaknesses lie. We were authorized by the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that was signed into law in 2009. The commission was... we've got 10 members. It's a bipartisan commission, a cross-section of experience in banking, market regulation, taxation, finance, economics, housing, and consumer protection. Chair is Phil Angelides. Vice Chair is Bill Thomas. They were selected by the jointly by the House and Senate minority committees. Now, something we often we like to start these out with. Oh, we've had one other person join us.
Mike Easterly. How do you do, Dr. Sharp?
Hi. Well, thank you.
Can I ask you to give a sort of a you don't have to go all the way back to the beginning, but sort of a recent bio of what you've been doing in the last few years and what you're doing right now?
Sure. And you know, I should warn you that I probably have relatively little, if anything, to add to what you already have, because this is, I think, a bit out of, more than a bit out of my area of expertise. I'm a financial economist. I have worked over the years on issues of how people or organizations should invest their money, say, for individuals, this would be saving, investing, buying annuities. My focus in that area now is almost exclusively on people who are in retirement or just have reached retirement and who have all these decisions now to make about and buying annuities, investing, spending, et cetera, so what I call post-retirement financial planning, economics, what have you. The other area, main area of my interest over many years has been equilibrium in capital markets, to make it sound a little more profound, but issues of how, at least in a well-functioning competitive market, you might expect prices to adjust and what the implications would be for risks and returns, and then, of course, the implications of that for the kinds of questions that I posed earlier for individuals and institutions. If markets are at least roughly like this, how should you make these financial decisions? So that's, you know, and I've been off in some other areas hither and yon, but those are kind of my main areas of work over many, many, many years.
Okay. Well, I don't expect you to have all the answers, but I felt it behooved us to ask you about your perspective. So let me start.
I'm honored to be asked.
Okay. Well, we're honored to speak with you. Did you at any point foresee a crisis of this magnitude?
I'm going to have to give a little nuanced answer. My whole career has been predicated on the fact that, at least in an efficient financial sector, it's probably impossible for anybody with any regularity to predict exactly what will happen to the price of an asset, to, you know, anything that involves competition in pricing. So what I basically have worked on are models and systems in which what you can predict at best is a probability distribution. So now let me come back to your question. You know, I don't make point predictions or single value predictions about anything connected with capital markets, nor do I think anybody can reliably do it over the course of time. So I twist that question to one of did I, at least in the probability distributions that I would come up with or that I would work with people to come up with, you know, I've consulted for CalPERS, as Phil knows, because we ran into each other there more than once. did I come up with or agree with probability distributions, which at least included a small probability, maybe very small, of something as bad as what happened 2007 to 2009? And I guess the answer is, yeah, in principle, it was in there. And in the Monte Carlo analyses that we did, say at CalPERS and that I've participated in other areas, yes, there was a scenario or two that was that bad in some sense. But the probabilities were pretty small. And I think this is true of most everybody who did this kind of analysis prior to 2007. Most of the Monte Carlo models have very, very small probabilities of something as egregious as what happened in that late 2007, early 2009 period. The easy way out is to say, hey, we said it could happen. It happened. And so here's a 1 in 500 years event, and we predicted it would be a 1 in 500 years. Guess what? It's happened. But if you look at the history, those sort of 1 in 500 predicted events, as most people make predictions, have happened at least 3 or 4 times in the last 150 years. So I think most people in the industry, and I'm talking now about the actuarial firms, the consulting firms who do this sort of thing for a living, have adjusted their models to include a higher probability, although still small, of something that bad happening again.
When you talk to a lot of people in the industry, they will point to their models, and models surprisingly pointed where people wanted them to go. Is there any way you can you do? Is there any method by which you can be sure that models are taking the right factors into consideration?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I mean it's at the end of the day. I mean there's a huge divide between academics and at least many practitioners, not all, in that academics have said from the beginning when we started building models of investment decision under uncertainty and equilibrium under uncertainty, we said that the probabilities that are appropriate are the ones arrived at generally subjectively for the future. You know, what's the probability that X will happen in the future? And that you can gain information and helpful data by looking at the past, but to just blindly assume that the frequencies with which things happened in the past are the best estimates of the probabilities they will happen in the future is not a very sensible thing to do. Lots of people in the industry have done that nonetheless. You say, well, we'll just take the returns on the S&P over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years, and we've got 40 numbers, let's say, there, and we'll just assume that next year you're going to get one of those 40 numbers. And that's pretty crude, and it doesn't use any intelligence at all. But once you recognize that you're supposed to bring more information to the table when you make your forward-looking probabilities, different people are going to come up with different probabilities, and that's what makes markets. That's a long answer to your question. I'm sorry for that.
No problem. This is Mike Easterly here.
A
lot of the risk managers that we talk to use the value at risk model. I guess some of the more sophisticated might have used the Gaussian copula, both of which, if I understand correctly, rely or assume a normal distribution. So my two questions are,
I'm sorry, can I?
Yeah.
Actually, maybe can I just intrude for a minute? I don't think that last statement is quite right.
Okay.
The value, and then there are two kind of different things. The value at risk is basically a measure on the probability distribution, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have the traditional 5% VAR value at risk, you just say, well, here's a number that I don't expect it to be worse than this 5% of the time. So it's kind of a place on a probability distribution, and I think most of us, or well, I'll speak for myself, I think that people need to see more than that, because 5% of the time is after all one time out of 20, and people often, there was a terribly alarming editorial. Mike Clouse, who was the former editor of Pensions and Investments, a major trade publication, after he retired and after the meltdown, wrote an op-ed piece in which he said, you know, I thought that the VAR was something that was the worst it could be. I didn't realize that 5% of the time it could be that bad. I didn't realize that 5% of the time it could be that bad or worse.
Okay. Right. Well, my next question.
That was pretty frightening. But
yeah.
But anyway, so that's what the VAR is. It is a point on the probability distribution. The copula is a very fancy way of building a system, and there are many other ways that are simpler to understand, in which it isn't a normal distribution. It has a fat left tail, so that and again, you can build a copula, and it's a multi-dimensional probability distribution, and that's about all I understand of it, to be perfectly frank. But they use that procedure, many people in the industry, to build probabilities which aren't normal. Many people traditionally actually use log normal rather than normal, which is probably not an important difference for this discussion.
Okay.
But again, there are two issues, and I think it's important to separate them. What do you think the probabilities are? And then when you communicate, if you're not going to show anybody the whole distribution, what do you tell them? And in many contexts, as you know, it's been a 5% VAR. Sometimes you'll get a 1% VAR, but that's only a point on a distribution. If you have a normal distribution and you tell somebody any two points on it, they can draw the rest of the distribution. But you need to know the shape of the distribution before you can figure out what the whole thing is from two or three numbers.
Professor Sharp, was there a moment that you felt that you recognized this was something bigger than the usual garden variety market correction?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, we all did at some point, and I can't tell you exactly when it was, but certainly, you know, started looking. I was around in, you know, on Black Monday when the market dropped 20. Well, various parts of the market dropped 22, 23, 25% in one day. So that was clearly something that we hadn't.
That was 1987 you're referring to.
Yes. No, I remember it, October or whatever it was, something.
Yeah.
1987, and I was at a meeting actually where many of us industry and academics were sitting around saying, what is happening here? But yeah, I certainly as it sort of went on, and I can't tell you when I said, you know, I think this is way out in the tail of the distribution. If you have a normal or a log normal distribution in your modeling, which most people did, there is some probability that the entire world will go to zero.
Right.
So to say, well, did you have it in your distribution? The cheap answer is, oh, yeah, we had it in there. But if you had it as one chance out of 10 million, you know, that kind of doesn't count. So I did some, in a couple of talks, I did some ex post analyses of the 2007 to 2009, the worst period, 14 months, whatever it was, a little more. And many people have done this. Said, well, according to the numbers we used for this study, that was a 1 in 500 years or a 1 in 1,000 years event. which in retrospect seems to be, you know, we underestimated the probability of that sort of thing happening. But again, I can't prove that. You know, I can't prove that you should assume that it's more likely to happen in the future, you know, with or without the financial reform and anything you guys can come up with. But the thing, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this, but some of the consulting firms, Towers Perrin is one in particular, have something that's really easy to understand. They in their Monte Carlo, they just build in, and others do this too, two regimes, sort of a normal functioning of the system and an abnormal or a financial crisis. And for the normal, you get things not perfectly correlated, and you get, you know, standard kind of risk and correlation. But you have, for the financial crisis, you have, you know, terrible expected returns, you have high correlations on the way down. And then in their Monte Carlo, they just sort of every year in the simulations flip a coin, and one chance out of 20 they pull from the crisis distribution, and 19 out of 20 they pull from the non-crisis distribution, and that generates the kind of fat tails that the Kubler methods do, and it's easy to understand. And then I guess if you take that, it's called a regime switching model, if you take that position, then I guess you could say, well, the job of your group and present and future reforms is to lower the probability of that crisis scenario.
Right. I was going to get back to some of the answers you were talking about with Mike. I've been hearing a lot of sort of anti-quant, anti-intellectual attacks at applying financial economics and modern science to financial markets. And I was wondering, I think the talks you've given recently, you had sort of evaluated, you know, this issue and where the theory held up, where it didn't hold up, what might have been some of the shortcomings of the theory in the crisis, or where some of the anti-quant sentiment may not be fair or be misperceived.
That's a big subject. I haven't actually spoken on it per se, nor have I chosen to write about it. I've stopped reading books on that subject. I think Justin Fox's was the last, and except for a couple of things, by far the best. But I can give you at least my take.
That'd be great.
You know, I think a lot of the ways in which financial economics was implemented were pretty naive. You know, there was a sense, and I blame the consulting community, and I guess I have some mea culpas there too, for making it seem more scientific than it was. The theories, be they normative theories a la Markowitz or equilibrium theories, again, are all built around consensus predictions, probabilistic consensus predictions. And in some sense, in the equilibrium theories, we say, well, the markets will, if they're competitive, reflect consensus, or an average, if you will, opinion of people about future possible outcomes and their probabilities. Now, that was very often coupled with the assumption that, you know, it's the wisdom of crowds argument that that consensus, which is embedded in prices and expected returns and such, has got to be better than any predictor or combination of predictors could make because of the wisdom of crowds, just to put it simply. And some people, I think, got a little more carried away with that assumption than others. So you got the hardline efficient marketeers and the somewhat more nuanced ones. But I, you know, what do I still think? After all of this, I think that markets really do, you know, at least in the long run, and at least for broad asset classes, reflect a consensus of people's opinions about future possible outcomes. And I also think that the evidence is pretty clear that there aren't very many who can consistently do a better job of making predictions than those that are embedded in the prices. You know, you can certainly find people who foresaw a disaster or foresaw a big bull market or foresaw wonderful times for stock X. But if you look at the record of professional investors, and that's another thing I've done, is a lot of risk analysis and performance analysis, and so I've done a lot of that, and both academically and consulting land, and I've looked at an awful lot of records of an awful lot of managers of mutual funds and institutional funds for pension funds and endowments, and the record, it's pretty consistent with the idea that this is a net negative sum game after costs, and that there are very few who can year in and year out make huge amounts of money with relatively little risk. So the markets may be crazy, but they're not that crazy.
It feels to me.
I was just going to ask him to follow up on what are some of the ways he thought there was a naive implementation of financial economic theory.
I didn't quite hear the full sentence.
Yeah, I'll repeat it. You had mentioned that you were concerned about a naive implementation of financial economic theory. I was wondering if you had some, if you could elaborate on where you thought.
Sure, I'll give you a case in point. A consultant, which will remain nameless, will come to, say, a large pension fund and say, we're going to do a scientific analysis of your asset allocation and what you really ought to be doing in terms of allocating your money among major asset classes. And they will produce their correlation matrix for the asset classes and their set of risks for the asset classes and their set of expected returns for the asset classes. And then they will do optimizations using quadratic programming and with various kinds of constraints in place, and they will come up with a set of asset allocations with different risks and expected returns, and then the committee or the board will choose one. They will probably do Monte Carlo analyses to show, you know, what the chances are you'll be fully funded in 10 years, etc. And there's a lot of apparatus and a lot of calculation and a lot of mathematics behind all that. But if you look at their inputs and say, well, now if we just, you know, let your optimizer go, what would it come up with? And you find it would come up with 40% in an asset class, which is only 3% of the entire market. You don't see that in the study because they've constrained it so that that doesn't show up. But you have to ask the question, now wait a minute, how can those estimates and expected returns and risk and correlations really be right? Now there's equilibrium theory that can keep you from making that mistake, but in my experience, very few consultants use it. And so they've taken some of financial economics, they haven't taken enough of it, and they've applied it in ways that seem ever so scientific to, you know, perhaps some very sophisticated members of a board, you know, an investment board committee for a pension fund or an endowment. But they're, you know, it leaves a lot to be desired.
So there's some ad hocery in the limits on the weights.
Yeah, and just one other example, just to give you a sense. I've seen complex studies of asset allocation for, say, a pension fund based on analyses of their liabilities, their pension obligations, And I'm, let's say now we're talking about a governmental plan. And as you well know, I think, I'm sure, governmental plans discount their liabilities at 7.5% or 8%. And in simulations, that rate often never changes. Well, that's just bad economics. There's no other term for it. And these purportedly scientific studies are all predicated on a disastrously wrong assumption, and which affects the outcome if you get it, if you change it to something more economically sensible.
Do you think in any of these cases that I guess the financial crisis amplified the downside of these poor decisions?
Well, I think the government, you know, and I should tell you, I was a consultant for CalPERS until last December, so I'm just talking about, you know, I'm not talking about CalPERS in particular. This is true, and most economists have bemoaned this whole problem in the government sector. It's not a big problem in the private sector because the FASB has taken a much more sensible view. But I don't, you know, that's a good question. I don't really know. You could certainly say that. Well, let's go back to the first issue. If you look at the market as a whole, the actual amounts invested in, say, venture capital, private equity, and of course hedge funds are a special case, are relatively small, but a number of players, pension funds and foundations and endowments, went way over market proportions in investing in some of those classes, and presumably because their consultants told them that this was, you know, this was a good deal. But if they say it going in, you might say, well, there's something wrong with those assumptions that the consultants are making. If those asset classes are as good as their numbers suggest, you know, why aren't they 30% of the market instead of 3%? So the question is, do you take the market's assessment of the value of those instruments or those asset classes or the consultants? And to the extent that, you know, the reality was closer to the market's estimates and the risk was greater than perhaps anticipated, yes, I think you could say that caused some problem. Whether or not, there are two kinds of problems as I see the crisis. One is it really hurts your fund, and the other is the whole contagion and systemic risk. Well, it hurts your fund, and then you do something that hurts somebody else's fund, and the whole, you know, issues that you're clearly focusing on. So I'm not so sure on the systemic front. I haven't really thought it through. But it certainly caused an awful lot of grief in places where I think people might not have taken some of those risks. Certainly the whole, I mean, the folk wisdom, which may or might not be true, that people really didn't think real estate, the probability of real estate falling 10, 20, 30, 40, 50% was so low as to be sensibly ignored. That almost certainly caused people, institutions, and individuals to take on more leverage than they would have had they made assumptions about that probability that were, at least in retrospect, more realistic. And that then, you know, cascaded.
A moment ago, you said a few things that made me think that it seems to me, in the wake of this crisis, you're speaking about, you're using a few more qualifiers to talk about efficient markets than you might have in the past. Is that true?
That's probably true. Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I think that's a fair statement. I will say, in my defense, I published a book in 2007, which was based on some lectures given earlier and was in final editing before anything really broke loose. you know, which talks about equilibrium where people have disagreements and some people have biases, etc. So, I mean, it's not as if I was unaware of that, and I wanted people to have a broader view of exactly what prices might or might not reflect in the market. So I was never, so you can look at, I'll just say, somebody could look at that and say, well, okay. And in my view, it was probably a little more nuanced than some people thought it was, who haven't read the book. But I think anybody, I haven't been teaching for a while, so, but the sort of the standard econ, finance one MBA course, I would think would need some adjustment. I was arguing in the book that people ought to teach finance the way I was doing it there, which is basically creating some individuals and putting them into a simulator and let them trade till they're done trading and see what the equilibrium looks like, and that allows you to look at issues where there's biased information and people are not perfectly informed and people have different preferences than the ones usually assumed, and markets don't have to, future prospects don't have to follow normal distributions or anything of the sort. So I was hoping people would give students a broader sense of than, everything is normally distributed or log normal and prices are always the best possible estimate of future prospects, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think a more rigorous application of the capital asset pricing model on real estate would have averted some of these problems?
Well, I think the big problem with real estate is that, unless you're willing to look at REIT prices, you've had, certainly until recently, very bad estimates of the values, or more importantly, the variations in the values. So the risk of real estate, as measured by variations in appraised values, was almost always understated. And people, a number of people, academics at least, recognize that. And consultants, in fairness, would, they used to put real estate risk, portfolio of real estate risk at 6% or 7%, and then they slowly cranked it up a bit. But I think not having daily, hourly, minute by minute marking to market, and it's true of others, it was true of substantially of venture capital, private equity, timber, commodities, not futures, but so the lack of a liquid market with price estimates tends to make you underestimate risk, and then of course when you want to get out at the price you thought it was worth, can't get out. You're either locked out up or they give up and market to market. So, yeah, I think underestimation of risks of appraised assets, that's more broadly, what's a problem.
Can you imagine a capital asset pricing model sort of tailored to the derivatives market?
Well, yes and no. a derivative, derivatives, you can make anything you want a derivative. It's called gambling in some quarters, but you and I can make a bet on anything, and that can be as complex a bet as we'd like to make it. So it can have a wildly non-normal distribution. We can create any distribution we want, for that matter, and people do. And in principle, the CAPM would say, well, whatever the distribution is, figure out what happens if you were to add it to a highly diversified portfolio of everything in the world, and the expected it should be priced so the expected return is commensurate on what happens to the risk of that world portfolio. And, you know, you could say that's fine. Well, despite the fact it's got a weird distribution, let's figure out its beta. And, you know, whatever its beta is, we'll figure out that should be the expected return, and then we'll crank that through the weird distribution and figure out what the price is. So, in principle, you can do that. But all that is, remember, predicated on the assumption that you are going to hold it as part of a highly diversified portfolio. If you're going to hold it as 90% of your wealth, then you need to look at a lot more than its impact on a highly diversified portfolio. And it's unlikely it's priced as if it were going to be put in a highly diversified portfolio.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me that was the problem with the Gauss and Coppola was that it assumed a constant correlation of the various elements in the pool, and that correlation tightened up. Doesn't
well,
count,
there's, that, you know, there's a technical issue there, which you know, is more complex than I'm going to make it. But if you assume that, let's say, there's a common factor like the market, the world economy, something like that, and then everything else has risks that sort of run around that. So just think about this common risk and then the specific risk of individual instruments or asset classes, if you want. And you might get that model absolutely spot on, but in a period in which the common factor doesn't move very much, you're going to see low correlations among the asset classes because they're going to be doing their things. And that's going to dominate what you've been observing in the variation. On the other hand, if you get a period when the common factor takes a huge move, as in the crisis, then you're going to see, during that period of movement, much tighter correlations because almost all the behavior of the individual components, the asset classes, is going to be dominated by that big financial crisis. So even though the model is absolutely right, and maybe even if you've got the probability distribution for that big common factor right, you're going to see historic periods with high correlations, and then periodically, if you include a period where most of what's happened is a crisis, you're going to see much higher correlations. So if you build your factor model right, is what I'm saying, then it will automatically take that into account. And so I think there's some misunderstanding. But again, when you use the simple correlation matrix, then you don't quite have it unless it's there very implicitly. It's better to build a factor modeling, I guess is what I'm saying, and then you can spend a lot of time worrying about the probability distribution of that common factor.
Isn't that a lesson we might have learned after LTCM or even after the 1987 market crash and program trading?
Yeah, we should have. I mean, I've been a proponent of factor models and written about them way back when and did some empirical work and used a technique called style analysis, I think the good simulations and the good analyses have those factors in there. But a simple correlation matrix probably doesn't have enough detail to capture that.
And Wall Street was enamored of those simple models.
Well, I wouldn't say totally. I mean, I can't speak for all of Wall Street by any means, but some of the sophisticated consultants, and I think some of the sophisticated investment banks, had those models. Some of the early derivatives models had factors in them, but again, I'm not close enough to the practice to really speak to it.
Right.
Well, I was wondering also in terms of your thinking about the efficient market theory, what you think of accounting methods that use level 2, level 3 pricing?
I'm not sure I know what those are.
In the absence of liquid markets, particularly liquid secondary markets for securities or derivatives,
I'm just talking about the banks that don't mark their loans down.
No, they do mark them, but they don't have market prices to mark the loans or the other, even the securities, because the securities, the market for those securities isn't trading. Then they're allowed to use what are called level two and level three methodologies. Level two is where you use a model to use a benchmark in some other market to calculate the value in a related market. And then level three is where the model doesn't, you only have a benchmark of a similar security, but you're really have only market values for some very basic factors like risk-free rate of interest or some market-wide implied probability or the like. And so, in other words, you'd be trying to come up with imagine with a Black-Scholes model where you don't have a spot price for the stock, but you do have implied volatility or risk-free rate and the strike, and you still have to come up with a price of the call. And so that would be something closer to level three.
Well, I mean, again, I'm sure the devil's in the details. You know, obviously any economist would say what you need to do is to do the very best you can to figure out a market price, were there a market. Now, then you can get into, well, what if to make a market there's a bid-ask spread that's humongous, what do you do then? Then you have to ask, well, do we want to value it at what we could sell it for? But certainly in principle, you want to do everything you can to get as close as possible to what, in many cases, you could sell it for. How you do that absent a good analog or actually a bid and ask for the instrument itself. You go to whatever you can find, and again, that's in your case of the derivative. If you have two of the three things the market would use to value it, then you just you should definitely use those, I would think, and come up with the best estimate you can get for the third thing that you don't have a number for. But it's my understanding, and this is based only on what I read in the papers typically, that there are some reasonable benchmarks for some of the things on some of the bank balance sheets, some of the loans, and the banks have been reluctant to go all the way to those numbers for reasons we all know. And that seems to me to be a very bad idea.
Well, shifting gears a little bit, I was wondering what you thought about the views of this guy Taleb, who wrote The Black Swan, and some of his criticism of modern finance.
Well, I don't know him personally. I've never met him or heard.
Well, I meant not him personally, but just
no. I understand, but that's just so you know. I loved his first book. I thought it was just great. I happened to just stumble on it at an airport somewhere before I'd read anything about it, and picked it up and read it, and I thought it was first class. The Black Swan book. First of all, I'm four square with the idea that, and again, it goes back to the things that we all wrote decades ago. You ought to be using in your analysis things that could happen and the probabilities that you assign to the possibilities that they will happen. And that would include things that maybe have never, ever happened before. Now, Taleb would say, well, there are things you can't even imagine, and so you'll never get them in your list. That may be true, but it seems to me that in a sense that's a counsel of despair. All you can do is, pull up the blankets and stay in bed. You're going to function. You've got to try to envision things that could happen and assign probabilities. But that certainly should include things, almost certainly, that have never happened. And many of us have tried to make that point over and over. I didn't read all of his book because after the Black Swan book, because after the first part, when it was getting very metaphysical, I fast-forwarded to the section about me and decided I didn't want to read anymore. But that being said, I think he's done a good service in bringing people's attention to the fact that it's things that could happen in the future that you have to try to take into account when you're operating in financial markets.
I think we're getting close to wrapping up. I got one more question, but we've got a... From any,
this is Alex Maggi, Dr. Sharp. I wanted to focus a little bit on regulation of markets in the sense that it seems, and feel free to agree or disagree, of course, that markets seem to be sort of naturally failing over time. If we look at savings and loan, LTCM to a smaller extent, and of course what's happened in the last few years. Is it your view that markets need to be regulated to be prevented from failing, or do we just have one set of data points and that, you know, maybe things will sort of evolve over time as they become more efficient?
Boy, that's a huge question. I think that if you just look at the way most of us think about the society we live in, almost everybody has some list of things where they think people should not be allowed to enter into agreements or engage with one another in certain ways. The easy ones are, well, you know, you should be precluded from, or at least constrained, or at least charged if you pollute my air, or if I'm likely to be caught in the crossfire when you're shooting it out with somebody in another gang. So we have those cases where it's not hard to get agreement. And then you shade off, bicycle helmets. Some people say, well, you should or you shouldn't. Most economists, I think, from early on would say if you and I want to do something that imposes an externality on someone else, that externality has to be captured on a Coase's theorem, one way or the other, and that ultimately is going to involve some sort of regulation, broadly construed, or legal arrangements in the society. When you get down to whether or not somebody should be allowed to invest in a hedge fund that's engaging in activities which the investor can't possibly understand, partly because the manager isn't telling them what they're doing. Should you protect people against that? Should you protect somebody from setting up a fund and leveraging it 40-1 if it's likely to take down 12 counterparties who have no notion what the collateral is? So there you get into a fuzzy area. I am probably more on the side of regulation than a number of my colleagues in the academic financial economics profession. But I can't give you a simple rule or a strong argument. I worry, my concern in for the last many years has been with the individual more than institutions, and I worry a lot about individuals. Part of the financial crisis, I don't know if you heard about the Lehman mini bonds in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and the Lehman certificates in Germany. These were all derivatives sold to individual investors, often by their local banks, that had counterparty risk up the gazoo. And I think it's really important that counterparty risk be either limited or for individuals. I'm not so much worried about some of the institutions, perhaps, but for individuals, they really understand what the counterparty risk may be to the extent anybody can, or be warned against taking it. I worry a lot about the rash of ETFs now, mm-hmm. That have no, the collateral is the bank. Mm-hmm. The old idea, an ETF is some kind of an interest in a pool of securities that are actually in a vault somewhere. We've gone so far beyond that now, and derivatives worry me a lot, and at the moment I'm worried mostly about individual investors, people saving for retirement, etc.
When you think about
whether you regulate, whether you preclude, whether you require collateral, whether you require disclosure, whether you do it in terms of pre-qualifying people for investing in certain things. I mean, there's a whole range of response there, but I do worry a lot about that, yes.
Well, I have one more question, and I'll get to it in a minute.
Hi, Dr. Sharp. This is Landon Strobel. You spoke earlier of the tendency of investors to underestimate risk of illiquid assets. I was curious whether you could identify some events in the crisis you might point to as being the best evidence for some of the qualifiers you mentioned earlier that you would place on efficient markets.
I think you may have me on this one. If a preponderance of investors underestimated the risk, and there was nobody on the other side to try to move in enough volume to equilibrate, that was definitely a problem. And I'm not enough of a student of financial institutions to really speak very sensibly about that. So I think I'll probably pass.
Anything else? Okay, actually. Alex's question anticipated mine. This is probably going to seem odd, but do you think you could get a quantitative measure of too big to fail by using the CAPM?
Wow. Well, that's a lot better. I was afraid you were going to ask me my opinion on too big to fail.
I get to that.
Well, unfortunately, I've at least in a public forum, answered the question, but it's not an informed answer, which I think I said, at the time somebody asked me. I'm very, I'll just tell you my prejudice. I'm very dubious about, I worry about the outcome between a regulatory system and the kinds of people that go into the financial and business. As we all know, there's some awfully smart people in the financial industry, and they have a very fleet of foot. And I think it's not a fair contest between regulations and regulators on the one hand, and those folks. I come out of that with the view that. I need to be convinced that there is some overwhelming benefit that goes with humongous institutions that overweights the danger that can arise. So I have a prejudice. I'm in the Simon Johnson school, I guess, that there ought to be some level beyond which you say, look, guys, why don't you sort of stop at this level? Now, whether it be size or activities, variations of the Volcker Rule. I have a knee-jerk reaction as to where I would go, but I mean it's not informed. But I think that's a serious problem. And to answer your specific question, is there any kind of scientific or pseudoscientific way to do it? I don't. If there is, I sure don't know what it is. I can't see at the moment how the CAPM in particular could do anything in that domain. We're really talking about failure of an institution, not pricing of instruments in a marketplace. And of course, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with an institution failing if everybody knew it could happen. And had a reasonable sense of the probabilities, and they don't take down somebody else that is in some sense an innocent bystander or who misunderstood what risk the institution was taking.
Without failure, though, if you looked at the financial services industry, there might be some measure. I don't know. If anything occurs to you, would you give me a call?
I will. But I think, you know, I guess my reaction is this is really an issue, if you will, of the probability distribution of that institution and by extension, its counterparties. Let me just say it so that it's out there. If you talk about derivatives going back to rice futures in Japan, we all know that they can do wondrous things. You know, they can allow the baker to hedge and the farmer to hedge and everybody is a winner. But we also know that they involve an awful lot of betting, and that betting can be helpful, especially to the hedgers. But there's a lot of betting, and it seems to me that there are at some point you have to ask, well, of the people who are playing in this particular derivatives domain, if 99 and 94/100% of them are gamblers, and there's almost nobody that's truly hedging, I think you have to ask, well, where does that cross the line? Maybe it's fine, and maybe we should let people gamble on anything they want. But I think there's been I think the proponents of derivatives have overstated the social welfare of at least some of the derivatives markets. And the other thing I would just say, I think it's important to understand that when you think about the classic case of the oil company and the airline using derivatives to hedge the risk of oil prices, if I hold a portfolio and I've got them both in my portfolio, what is that all about? I mean, it's understanding that it's important for both of them to have operational advantages and not having to worry about those range of changes. But I think some people and some academics, I think, have become so enamored with how much fun it is to invent really complex derivatives, you know, that can provide all kinds of payoff functions, that they've tended to lose sight of the fact that the world may not need some of those derivatives that were invented and in use. And I think some of that will cure in time. It's been our experience in most derivatives markets that they aren't priced particularly well initially, but people learn how to use them. Prices become more sensible and the uses become more sensible, so maybe time will cure it. But you have to worry about new financial innovations, because I think they can cause some serious damage. For a while.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think you were, do I misunderstand you, or you were saying that if everything is perfectly hedged, you get no, it sort of takes it takes the wind out of the market?
Well, I mean, you could have the classic futures market, the farmer and the baker hedging the price of grain. You could have that with no speculators at all. But as a practical matter, those markets attract speculators, and many of them you need speculators because there aren't quite as many at any given time on one side of the hedge as on the other side. So most derivatives markets going back, you know, centuries now, have a combination of betting and hedging, which is fine. But I think if you look at a market and you say, well, how much of that activity on both sides is really hedging and how much is betting, and if you're honest about it, and, you know, there's a lot of betting done by corporate treasurers.
Right.
It's always clothed in, this is a hedge, we've got to hedge this risk, or it's often, but a lot of it, if you look hard at it, seems a lot more like betting. And again, you get very metaphysical about this, but I think the idea that everybody should be allowed to do, private over-the-counter derivatives for anything they want. You know, we stopped short. I think it's still true. You can't do it on the 49ers game.
Right. You could try.
But we came close in some internet offerings. But you know, I think most people would say, no, you should let people do that.
So I'm sorry, are you worried about speculators driving prices away from fundamentals?
I am, but I don't know how I would tell you ex ante when they've done it. You know, I'm not that smart. But yeah, I mean, presumably, I mean, the whole notion of competitive, I like to use the word competitive markets rather than efficient because it's a little less loaded, but the idea of competitive markets is that speculators are driving the price of something away from what it's truly worth. Somebody who's smarter will say, well, I can take advantage of them and act in ways that will bring that price at least back closer to what it should be worth. And, you know, my solution for individuals is, you know, just buy almost everything. And then you're likely to get about as many overpriced instruments as you get underpriced. But I think that's still pretty good advice, by the way. To go back to your question, what's left after the assault on financial economics? I think that's still pretty good advice.
Diversification still the only free lunch in economics?
May not be the only one, but it's a pretty good one.
Dr. Sharp, thank you very much. I think that wraps things up for us. And the only thing I can say is that if we have additional questions, I hope we can get back to you.
Sure thing. Feel free. And I thank you for all your time. And I appreciate the opportunity. Do good work. I know you will. You are and you will. It's really important what you're doing.
Thanks very much.
Look forward to the results.
Thanks very much.
Okay, great. Thanks all.
Bye.
Bye.